that is too narrow a view. We are more than just our genes. We may be no stronger or inherently more intelligent than our cavemen ancestors, but what distinguishes us from them is the knowledge that we have accumulated over the last 10,000 years, and particularly over the last 300. I think it is legitimate to take a broader view and include externally transmitted information, as well as DNA, in the evolution of the human race. The timescale for evolution in the external transmission period is the timescale for accumulation of information. This used to be hundreds or even thousands of years. But now this timescale has shrunk to about 50 years or less. On the other hand, the brains with which we process this information have evolved only on the Darwinian timescale, of hundreds of thousands of years. This is beginning to cause problems. In the 18th century, there was said to be a man who had read every book written. But nowadays, if you read one book a day, it would take you many tens of thousands of years to read through the books in a national library, by which time many more books would have been written. This has meant that no one person can be the master of more than a small corner of human knowledge. People have to specialize in narrower and narrower fields. This is likely to be a major limitation in the future. We certainly cannot continue for long with the exponential rate of growth of knowledge that we have had in the last 300 years. An even greater limitation and danger for future generations is that we still have the instincts and, in particular, the aggressive impulses that we had in caveman days. Aggression, in the form of subjugating or killing other men and taking their women and food, has had definite survival advantages up to the present time, but now it could destroy the entire human race and much of the rest of life on Earth. A nuclear war is still the most immediate danger. But there are others, such as the release of a genetically engineered virus, or the greenhouse effect becoming unstable. There is no time to wait for Darwinian evolution to make us more intelligent and better natured. But we are now entering a new phase of what might be called self-designed evolution, in which we will be able to change and improve our DNA. We have now mapped DNA, which means we have read the Book of Life, so we can start writing in corrections. At first, these changes will be confined to the repair of genetic defects, like cystic fibrosis and muscular dystrophy, which are controlled by single genes and so are fairly easy to identify and correct. Other qualities, such as intelligence, are probably controlled by a large number of genes, and it will be much more difficult to find them and work out the relations between them. Nevertheless, I am sure that during this century, people will discover how to modify both intelligence and instincts, like aggression. Laws will probably be passed against genetic engineering with humans, but some people won't be able to resist the temptation to improve human characteristics, such as size of memory, resistance to disease, and length of life. Once such superhumans appear, there are going to be major political problems with the unimproved humans who won't be able to compete. Presumably, they will die out or become unimportant. Instead, there will be a race of self-designing beings who are improving themselves at an ever-increasing rate. If the human race manages to redesign itself, to reduce or eliminate the risk of self-destruction, it will probably spread out and colonize other planets and stars. However, long-distance space travel will be difficult for chemically-based life forms like us, based on DNA. The natural lifetime for such beings is short compared with the travel time. According to the theory of relativity, nothing can travel faster than light, so a round trip from us to the nearest star would take at least 8 years, and to the center of the galaxy, about 50,000 years. In science fiction, they overcome this difficulty by space warps, or travel through extra dimensions. But I don't think these will ever be possible, no matter how intelligent life becomes. In the theory of relativity, if one can travel faster than light, one can also travel back in time. And this would lead to problems with people going back and changing the past. One would also expect to have already seen large numbers of tourists from the future, curious to look at our quaint, old-fashioned ways. It might be possible to use genetic engineering to make DNA-based life survive indefinitely, or at least for 100,000 years. But an easier way, which is almost within our capabilities already, would be to send machines. These could be designed to last long enough for interstellar travel. When they arrived at a new star, they could land on a suitable planet and mine material to produce more machines which could be sent on to get more stars. These machines would be a new form of life, based on mechanical and electronic components rather than macromolecules. They could eventually replace DNA-based life, just as DNA may have replaced an earlier form of life. What are the chances that we will encounter some alien form of life as we explore the galaxy? If the argument about the timescale for the appearance of life on Earth is correct, there ought to be many other stars whose planets have life on them. Some of these stellar systems could have formed 5 billion years before the Earth. So why is the galaxy not crawling with self-designing mechanical or biological life forms? Why hasn't the Earth been visited and even colonized? By the way, I discount suggestions that UFOs contain beings from outer space, as I think that any visits by aliens would be much more obvious, and probably also much more unpleasant. So why haven't we been visited? Maybe the probability of life spontaneously appearing is so low that the Earth is the only planet in the galaxy or in the observable universe on which it happened. Another possibility is that there was a reasonable probability of forming self-reproducing systems like cells, but that most of these forms of life did not evolve intelligence. We are used to thinking of intelligent life as an inevitable consequence of evolution. But what if it isn't? The anthropic principle should warn us to be wary of such arguments. It is more likely that evolution is a random process, with intelligence as only one of a large number of possible outcomes. It is not even clear that intelligence has any long-term survival value. Bacteria and other single-cell organisms may live on if all other life on Earth is wiped out by our actions. Perhaps intelligence was an unlikely development for life on Earth, from the chronology of evolution, as it took a very long time, 2.5 billion years, to go from single cells to multicellular beings, which are a necessary precursor to intelligence. This is a good fraction of the total time available before the sun blows up, so it would be consistent with the hypothesis that the probability for life to develop intelligence is low. In this case, we might expect to find many other life forms in the galaxy, but we are unlikely to find intelligent life. Another way in which life could fail to develop an intelligent stage would be if an asteroid or comet were to collide with the planet. In 1994, we observed the collision of a comet, Shoemaker-Levy, with Jupiter. It produced a series of enormous fireballs. It is thought the collision of a rather smaller body with the Earth, about 66 million years ago, was responsible for the extinction of the dinosaurs. A few small early mammals survived, but anything as large as a human would have almost certainly been wiped out. It is difficult to say how often such collisions occur, but a reasonable guess might be every 20 million years on average. If this figure is correct, it would mean that intelligent life on Earth has developed only because of the lucky chance that there have been no major collisions in the last 66 million years. Other planets in the galaxy, on which life has developed, may not have had a long enough collision-free period to evolve intelligent beings. A third possibility is that there is a reasonable probability for life to form and to evolve to intelligent beings, but the system becomes unstable and the intelligent life destroys itself. This would be a very pessimistic conclusion, and I very much hope it isn't true. I prefer a fourth possibility, that there are other forms of intelligent life out there, but that we've been overlooked. In 2015, I was involved in the launch of the Breakthrough Listen initiatives. Breakthrough Listen uses radio observations to search for intelligent extraterrestrial life and has state-of-the-art facilities, generous funding, and thousands of hours of dedicated radio telescope time. It is the largest ever scientific research program aimed at finding evidence of civilizations beyond Earth. Breakthrough Message is an international competition to create messages that could be read by an advanced civilization. But we need to be wary of answering back until we have developed a bit further. Meeting a more advanced civilization at our present stage might be a bit like the original inhabitants of America meeting Columbus, and I don't think that they thought they were better off for it.
If intelligent life exists somewhere else than on Earth, would it be similar to the forms we know, or different?
Is there intelligent life on Earth? But seriously, if there is intelligent life elsewhere, it must be a very long way away, otherwise it would have visited Earth by now. And I think we would have known if we had been visited. It would be like the film Independence Day.
4. Can we predict the future? In ancient times, the world must have seemed pretty arbitrary. Disasters such as floods, plagues, earthquakes or volcanoes must have seemed to happen without warning or apparent reason. Primitive people attributed such natural phenomena to a pantheon of gods and goddesses who behaved in a capricious and whimsical way. There was no way to predict what they would do, and the only hope was to win favour by gifts or actions. Many people still partially subscribe to this belief and try to make a pact with fortune. They offer to behave better or be kinder if only they can get an A grade for a course or pass their driving test. Gradually, however, people must have noticed certain regularities in the behaviour of nature. These regularities were most obvious in the motion of the heavenly bodies across the sky. So astronomy was the first science to be developed. It was put on a firm mathematical basis by Newton more than 300 years ago, and we still use his theory of gravity to predict the motion of almost all celestial bodies. Following the example of astronomy, it was found that other natural phenomena also obeyed definite scientific laws. This led to the idea of scientific determinism, which seems first to have been publicly expressed by the French scientist Pierre-Simon Laplace. I would like to quote to you Laplace's actual words, but Laplace was rather like Proust, in that he wrote sentences of inordinate length and complexity. So I have decided to paraphrase the quotation. In effect, what he said was that if at one time we knew the positions and speeds of all the particles in the universe, then we would be able to calculate their behaviour at any other time in the past or future. There is a probably apocryphal story that when Laplace was asked by Napoleon how God fitted into this system, he replied, "Sire, I have not needed that hypothesis." I don't think that Laplace was claiming that God didn't exist. It is just that God doesn't intervene to break the laws of science. That must be the position of every scientist. A scientific law is not a scientific law if it only holds when some supernatural being decides to let things run and not intervene. The idea that the state of the universe at one time determines the state at all other times has been a central tenet of science ever since Laplace's time. It implies that we can predict the future, in principle at least. In practice, however, our ability to predict the future is severely limited by the complexity of the equations and the fact that they often have a property called chaos. As those who have seen Jurassic Park will know, this means a tiny disturbance in one place can cause a major change in another. A butterfly flapping its wings in Australia can cause rain in Central Park, New York. The trouble is, it is not repeatable. The next time the butterfly flaps its wings, a host of other things will be different, which will also influence the weather. This chaos factor is why weather forecasts can be so unreliable. Despite these practical difficulties, scientific determinism remained the official dogma throughout the 19th century. However, in the 20th century, there were two developments that show that Laplace's vision of a complete prediction of the future cannot be realized. The first of these developments was what is called quantum mechanics. This was put forward in 1900 by the German physicist Max Planck as an ad hoc hypothesis to solve an outstanding paradox. According to the classical 19th century ideas dating back to Laplace, a hot body, like a piece of red-hot metal, should give off radiation. It would lose energy in radio waves, the infrared, visible light, ultraviolet, X-rays, and gamma rays, all at the same rate. This would mean not only that we would all die of skin cancer, but also that everything in the universe would be at the same temperature, which clearly it isn't. However, Planck showed one could avoid this disaster if one gave up the idea that the amount of radiation could have just any value, and said instead that radiation came only in packets or quanta of a certain size. It's a bit like saying that you can't buy sugar loose in the supermarket, it has to be in kilogram bags. The energy in the packets, or quanta, is higher for ultraviolet and X-rays than for infrared or visible light. It means that unless a body is very hot, like the sun, it will not have enough energy to give off even a single quantum of ultraviolet or X-rays. That is why we don't get sunburn from a cup of coffee. Planck regarded the idea of quanta as just a mathematical trick, and not as having any physical reality, whatever that might mean. However, physicists began to find other behaviour that could be explained only in terms of quantities having discrete or quantized values, rather than continuously variable ones. For example, it was found that elementary particles behaved rather like little tops spinning about an axis. But the amount of spin couldn't have just any value. It had to be some multiple of a basic unit. Because this unit is very small, one does not notice that a normal top really slows down in a rapid sequence of discrete steps, rather than as a continuous process. But for tops as small as atoms, the discrete nature of spin is very important. It was some time before people realized the implications of this quantum behavior for determinism. It was not until 1927 that Werner Heisenberg, another German physicist, pointed out that you couldn't measure simultaneously both the position and the speed of a particle exactly. To see where a particle is, one has to shine light on it. But by Planck's work, one can't use an arbitrarily small amount of light. One has to use at least one quantum. This will disturb the particle and change its speed in a way that can't be predicted. To measure the position of the particle accurately, you will have to use light of short wavelength, like ultraviolet, X-rays, or gamma rays. But again, by Planck's work, quanta of these forms of light have higher energies than those of visible light, so they will disturb the speed of the particle more. It is a no-win situation. The more accurately you try to measure the position of the particle, the less accurately you can know the speed and vice versa. This is summed up in the uncertainty principle that Heisenberg formulated. The uncertainty in the position of a particle times the uncertainty in its speed is always greater than a quantity called Planck's constant, divided by twice the mass of the particle. Laplace's vision of scientific determinism involved knowing the positions and speeds of the particles in the universe at one instant of time. So it was seriously undermined by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. How could one predict the future when one could not measure accurately both the positions and the speeds of particles at the present time? No matter how powerful a computer you have, if you put lousy data in, you will get lousy predictions out. Einstein was very unhappy about this apparent randomness in nature. His views were summed up in his famous phrase, "God does not play dice." He seemed to have felt that the uncertainty was only provisional, and that there was an underlying reality in which particles would have well-defined positions and speeds and would evolve according to deterministic laws in the spirit of Laplace. This reality might be known to God, but the quantum nature of light would prevent us seeing it, except through a glass darkly. Einstein's view was what would now be called a hidden variable theory. Hidden variable theories might seem to be the most obvious way to incorporate the uncertainty principle into physics. They form the basis of the mental picture of the universe held by many scientists and almost all philosophers of science. But these hidden variable theories are wrong. The British physicist John Bell devised an experimental test that could falsify hidden variable theories. When the experiment was carried out carefully, the results were inconsistent with hidden variables. Thus it seems that even God is bound by the uncertainty principle and cannot know both the position and the speed of a particle. All the evidence points to God being an inveterate gambler who throws the dice on every possible occasion. Other scientists were much more ready than Einstein to modify the classical 19th century view of determinism. A new theory, quantum mechanics, was put forward by Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger from Austria, and the British physicist Paul Dirac. Dirac was my predecessor but one as the Lucasian professor in Cambridge. Although quantum mechanics has been around for nearly 70 years, it is still not generally understood or appreciated, even by those who use it to do calculations. Yet it should concern us all, because it is completely different from the classical picture of the physical universe and of reality itself. In quantum mechanics, Particles don't have well-defined positions and speeds. Instead, they are represented by what is called a wave function. This is a number at each point of space. The size of the wave function gives the probability that the particle will be found in that position. The rate at which the wave function varies from point to point gives the speed of the particle. One can have a wave function that is very strongly peaked in a small region. This will mean that the uncertainty in the position is small. But the wave function will vary very rapidly near the peak, up on one side and down on the other. Thus the uncertainty in the speed will be large. Similarly, one can have wave functions where the uncertainty in the speed is small, but the uncertainty in the position is large. The wave function contains all that one can know of the particle, both its position and its speed. If you know the wave function at one time, then its values at other times are determined by what is called the Schrödinger equation. Thus one still has a kind of determinism, but it is not the sort that Laplace envisaged. Instead of being able to predict the positions and speeds of particles, all we can predict is the wave function. This means that we can predict just half of what we could, according to the classical 19th century view. Although quantum mechanics leads to uncertainty when we try to predict both the position and the speed, it still allows us to predict with certainty one combination of position and speed. However, even this degree of certainty seems to be threatened by more recent developments. The problem arises because gravity can warp space-time so much that there can be regions of space that we can't observe. Such regions are the interiors of black holes. That means that we cannot, even in principle, observe the particles inside a black hole, so we cannot measure their positions or velocities at all. There is then an issue of whether this introduces further unpredictability beyond that found in quantum mechanics. To sum up, the classical view, put forward by Laplace, was that the future motion of particles was completely determined if one knew their positions and speeds at one time. This view had to be modified when Heisenberg put forward his uncertainty principle, which said that one could not know both the position and the speed accurately. However, it was still possible to predict one combination of position and speed. But perhaps even this limited predictability might disappear if black holes are taken into account.
Do the laws governing the universe allow us to predict exactly what is going to happen to us in the future?
The short answer is no, and yes. In principle, the laws allow us to predict the future. But in practice, the calculations are often too difficult.
5. What is inside a black hole? It is said that fact is sometimes stranger than fiction. And nowhere is that more true than in the case of black holes. Black holes are stranger than anything dreamed up by science fiction writers, but they are firmly matters of science fact. The first discussion of black holes was in 1783 by a Cambridge man, John Michell. His argument ran as follows. If one fires a particle, such as a cannonball, vertically upwards, it will be slowed down by gravity. Eventually, the particle will stop moving upwards and will fall back. However, if the initial upwards velocity were greater than some critical value, called the escape velocity, gravity would never be strong enough to stop the particle and it would get away. The escape velocity is just over 11 kilometers per second for the Earth and about 617 kilometers per second for the Sun. Both of these are much higher than the speed of real cannonballs. But they are low compared to the speed of light, which is 300,000 kilometers per second. Thus, light can get away from the Earth or Sun without much difficulty. However, Michel argued that there could be stars that were much more massive than the Sun, which had escape velocities greater than the speed of light. We would not be able to see them, because any light they sent out would be dragged back by gravity. Thus, they would be what Michel called dark stars, what we now call black holes. To understand them, we need to start with gravity. Gravity is described by Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is a theory of space and time as well as gravity. The behavior of space and time is governed by a set of equations called the Einstein equations, which Einstein put forward in 1915. Although gravity is by far the weakest of the known forces of nature, it has two crucial advantages over other forces. First, it acts over a long range. The Earth is held in orbit by the Sun 93 million miles away, and the Sun is held in orbit around the center of the galaxy, about 10,000 light-years away. The second advantage is that gravity is always attractive, unlike electric forces which can be either attractive or repulsive. These two features mean that for a sufficiently large star, the gravitational attraction between particles can dominate all other forces and lead to gravitational collapse. Despite these facts, the scientific community was slow to realize that massive stars could collapse in on themselves under their own gravity and to figure out how the object left behind would behave. Albert Einstein even wrote a paper in 1939 claiming that stars could not collapse under gravity because matter could not be compressed beyond a certain point. Many scientists shared Einstein's gut feeling. The principal exception was the American scientist John Wheeler, who in many ways is the hero of the black hole story. In his work in the 1950s and 1960s, he emphasized that many stars would eventually collapse and explored the problems this posed for theoretical physics. He also foresaw many of the properties of the objects which collapsed stars become, that is, black holes. During most of the life of a normal star, over many billions of years, it will support itself against its own gravity by thermal pressure caused by nuclear processes, which convert hydrogen into helium. Eventually, however, the star will exhaust its nuclear fuel. The star will contract. In some cases, it may be able to support itself as a white dwarf star, the dense remnants of a stellar core. However, Subramanian Chandrasekhar showed in 1930 that the maximum mass of a white dwarf star is about 1.4 times that of the Sun. A similar maximum mass was calculated by the Russian physicist Lev Landau for a star made entirely of neutrons. What would be the fate of those countless stars with a greater mass than the maximum mass of a white dwarf or neutron star once they had exhausted nuclear fuel? The problem was investigated by Robert Oppenheimer, of later atom bomb fame. In a couple of papers in 1939, with George Volkoff and Hartland Snyder, he showed that such a star could not be supported by pressure, and that if one neglected pressure, a uniform, spherically systematic, symmetric star would contract to a single point of infinite density. Such a point is called a singularity. All our theories of space are formulated on the assumption that space-time is smooth and nearly flat. So they break down at the singularity where the curvature of space-time is infinite. In fact, it marks the end of space and time itself. That is what Einstein found so objectionable. Then the Second World War intervened. Most scientists, including Robert Oppenheimer, switched their attention to nuclear physics, and the issue of gravitational collapse was largely forgotten. Interest in the subject revived with the discovery of distant objects called quasars. The first quasar, 3C273, was found in 1963. Many other quasars were soon discovered. They were bright, despite being at great distances from the Earth. Nuclear processes could not account for their energy output because they release only a small fraction of their rest mass as pure energy. The only alternative was gravitational energy released by gravitational collapse. Gravitational collapse of stars was rediscovered. When this happens, the gravity of the object draws all its surrounding matter inwards. It was clear that a uniform, spherical star would contract to a point of infinite density, a singularity. But what would happen if the star isn't uniform and spherical? Could this unequal distribution of the star's matter cause a non-uniform collapse and avoid a singularity? In a remarkable paper in 1965, Roger Penrose showed there would still be a singularity using only the fact that gravity is attractive. The Einstein equations can't be defined at a singularity. This means that at this point of infinite density, one can't predict the future. This implies that something strange could happen whenever a star collapsed. We wouldn't be affected by the breakdown of prediction if the singularities are not naked, that is, they are not shielded from the outside. Penrose proposed the cosmic censorship conjecture. All singularities formed by the collapse of stars or other bodies are hidden from view inside black holes. A black hole is a region where gravity is so strong that light cannot escape. The cosmic censorship conjecture is almost certainly true because a number of attempts to disprove it have failed. When John Wheeler introduced the term black hole in 1967, it replaced the earlier name of frozen star. Wheeler's coinage emphasized that the remnants of collapsed stars are of interest in their own right, independently of how they were formed. The new name caught on quickly. From the outside, you can't tell what is inside a black hole. Whatever you throw in, or however it is formed, black holes look the same. John Wheeler is known for expressing this principle as a black hole has no hair. A black hole has a boundary called the event horizon. It is where gravity is just strong enough to drag light back and prevent it from escaping. Because nothing can travel faster than light, everything else will get dragged back also. Falling through the event horizon is a bit like going over Niagara Falls in a canoe. If you are above the falls, you can get away if you paddle fast enough. But once you are over the edge, you are lost. There's no way back. As you get nearer the falls, the current gets faster. This means it pulls harder on the front of the canoe than the back. There's a danger that the canoe will be pulled apart. It is the same with black holes. If you fall towards a black hole feet first, gravity will pull harder on your feet than your head, because they are nearer the black hole. The result is that you will be stretched out lengthwise and squashed in sideways. If the black hole has a mass of a few times our sun, you would be torn apart and made into spaghetti before you reached the horizon. However, if you fell into a much larger black hole with a mass of more than a million times the sun, the gravitational pull would be the same on the whole of your body, and you would reach the horizon without difficulty. So, if you want to explore the inside of a black hole, make sure you choose a big one. There is a black hole with a mass of about 4 million times that of the sun at the center of our Milky Way galaxy. Although you wouldn't notice anything in particular as you fell into a black hole, someone watching you from a distance would never see you cross the event horizon. Instead, you would appear to slow down and hover just outside. Your image would get dimmer and dimmer and redder, until you were effectively lost from sight. As far as the outside world is concerned, you would be lost forever. Shortly after the birth of my daughter Lucy, I had a eureka moment. I discovered the area theorem. If general relativity is correct, and the energy density of matter is positive, as is usually the case, then the surface area of the event horizon, the boundary of a black hole, has the property that it always increases when additional matter or radiation falls into the black hole. Moreover, if two black holes collide and merge to form a single black hole, the area of the event horizon around the resulting black hole is greater than the sum of the areas of the event horizons around the original black holes. The area theorem can be tested experimentally by the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO. On 14th of September 2015, LIGO detected gravitational waves from the collision and merger of two black holes. From the waveform, one can estimate the masses and angular momenta of the black holes, and by the no-hair theorem, these determine the horizon areas. These properties suggest that there is a resemblance between the area of the event horizon of a black hole and conventional classical physics, specifically the concept of entropy and thermodynamics. Entropy can be regarded as a measure of the disorder of a system, or equivalently, as a lack of knowledge of its precise state. The famous second law of thermodynamics says that entropy always increases with time. This discovery was the first hint of this crucial connection. The analogy between the properties of black holes and the laws of thermodynamics can be extended. The first law of thermodynamics says that a small change in the entropy of a system is accompanied by a proportional change in the energy of the system. Brandon Carter, Jim Bardeen and I found a similar law relating the change in mass of a black hole to a change in the area of the event horizon. Here, The factor of proportionality involves a quantity called the surface gravity, which is a measure of the strength of the gravitational field at the event horizon. If one accepts that the area of the event horizon is analogous to entropy, then it would seem that the surface gravity is analogous to temperature. The resemblance is strengthened by the fact that the surface gravity turns out to be the same at all points on the event horizon, just as the temperature is the same everywhere in a body at thermal equilibrium. Although there is clearly a similarity between entropy and the area of the event horizon, it was not obvious to us how the area could be identified as the entropy of a black hole itself. What would be meant by the entropy of a black hole? The crucial suggestion was made in 1972 by Jacob Bekenstein, who was a graduate student at Princeton University. It goes like this. When a black hole is created by gravitational collapse, it rapidly settles down to a stationary state, which is characterized by three parameters: the mass, the angular momentum, and the electric charge. This makes it look as if the final black hole state is independent of whether the body that collapsed was composed of matter or antimatter, or whether it was spherical or highly irregular in shape. In other words, a black hole of a given mass, angular momentum, and electric charge could have been formed by the collapse of any one of a large number of different configurations of matter. So what appears to be the same black hole could be formed by the collapse of a large number of different types of star. Indeed, if quantum effects are neglected, the number of configurations would be infinite, since the black hole could have been formed by the collapse of a cloud of an indefinitely large number of particles of indefinitely low mass. But could the number of configurations really be infinite? Quantum mechanics famously involves the uncertainty principle. This states that it is impossible to measure both the position and speed of any object. If one measures exactly where something is, then its speed is undetermined. If one measures the speed of something, then its position is undetermined. In practice, this means it is impossible to localize anything. Suppose you want to measure the size of something, then you need to figure out where the ends of this moving object are. You can never do this accurately, because it will involve making a measurement of both the positions of something and its speed at the same time. In turn, it is then impossible to determine the size of an object. All you can do is to say that the uncertainty principle makes it impossible to say precisely what the size of something really is. It turns out that the uncertainty principle imposes a limit on the size of something. After a little bit of calculation, one finds that for a given mass of an object, there is a minimum size. This minimum size is small for heavy objects, but as one looks at lighter and lighter objects, the minimum size gets bigger and bigger. This minimum size can be thought of as a consequence of the fact that in quantum mechanics, objects can be thought of either as a wave or a particle. The lighter an object is, the longer its wavelength is, and so it is more spread out. The heavier an object is, the shorter its wavelength, and so it will seem more compact. When these ideas are combined with those of general relativity, it means that only objects heavier than a particular weight can form black holes. That weight is about the same as that of a grain of salt. A further consequence of these ideas is that the number of configurations that could form a black hole of a given mass, angular momentum, and electric charge, although very large, may also be finite. Jacob Bekenstein suggested that from this finite number, one could interpret the entropy of a black hole. This would be a measure of the amount of information that seems irretrievably lost during the collapse when a black hole is created. The apparently fatal flaw in Bekenstein's suggestion was that if a black hole has a finite entropy that is proportional to the area of its event horizon, it also ought to have a non-zero temperature, which would be proportional to its surface gravity. This would imply that a black hole could be in equilibrium with thermal radiation at some temperature other than zero. Yet according to classical concepts, no such equilibrium is possible since the black hole would absorb any thermal radiation that fell on it, but by definition would not be able to emit anything in return. It cannot emit anything. It cannot emit heat. This created a paradox about the nature of black holes, the incredibly dense objects created by the collapse of stars. One theory suggested that black holes with identical qualities could be formed from an infinite number of different types of stars, Another suggested that the number could be finite. This is a problem of information. The idea that every particle and every force in the universe contains information. Because black holes have no hair, as the scientist John Wheeler put it, one can't tell from the outside what is inside a black hole, apart from its mass, electric charge, and rotation. This means that a black hole must contain a lot of information that is hidden from the outside world. But there is a limit to the amount of information one can pack into a region of space. Information requires energy, and energy has mass, by Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared. So if there's too much information in a region of space, it will collapse into a black hole, and the size of the black hole will reflect the amount of information. It's like piling more and more books into a library. Eventually the shelves will give way, and the library will collapse into a black hole. If the amount of hidden information inside a black hole depends on the size of the hole, one would expect from general principles that the black hole would have a temperature and would glow, like a piece of hot metal. But that was impossible, because as everyone knew, nothing could get out of a black hole. Or so it was thought. This problem remained until early in 1974, when I was investigating what the behaviour of matter in the vicinity of a black hole would be according to quantum mechanics. To my great surprise, I found that the black hole seemed to emit particles at a steady rate. Like everyone else at that time, I accepted the dictum that a black hole could not emit anything. I therefore put quite a lot of effort into trying to get rid of this embarrassing effect. But the more I thought about it, the more it refused to go away, so that in the end I had to accept it. What finally convinced me it was a real physical process was that the outgoing particles have a spectrum that is precisely thermal. My calculations predicted that a black hole creates and emits particles and radiation, just as if it were an ordinary hot body, with a temperature that is proportional to the surface gravity and inversely proportional to the mass. This made the problematic suggestion of Jacob Bekenstein that a black hole had a finite entropy fully consistent, since it implied that a black hole could be in thermal equilibrium at some finite temperature other than zero. Since that time, the mathematical evidence that black holes emit thermal radiation has been confirmed by a number of other people with various different approaches. One way to understand the emission is as follows. Quantum mechanics implies that the whole of space is filled with pairs of virtual particles and antiparticles that are constantly materializing in pairs, separating and then coming together again and annihilating each other. These particles are called virtual because, unlike real particles, they cannot be observed directly with a particle detector. Their indirect effects can nonetheless be measured, and their existence has been confirmed by a small shift called the Lamb shift, which they produce in the spectrum energy of light from excited hydrogen atoms. Now, in the presence of a black hole, one member of a pair of virtual particles may fall into the hole, leaving the other member without a partner with which to engage in mutual annihilation. The forsaken particle or antiparticle may fall into the black hole after its partner, but it may also escape to infinity, where it appears to be radiation emitted by the black hole. Another way of looking at the process is to regard the member of the pair of particles that falls into the black hole, the antiparticle, say, as being really a particle that is travelling backwards in time. Thus, the antiparticle falling into the black hole can be regarded as a particle coming out of the black hole, but travelling backwards in time. When the particle reaches the point at which the particle-antiparticle pair originally materialized, it is scattered by the gravitational field, so that it travels forward in time. A black hole of the mass of the Sun would leak particles at such a slow rate that it would be impossible to detect. However, there could be much smaller mini black holes with the mass of, say, a mountain. These might have formed in the very early universe if it had been chaotic and irregular. A mountain-sized black hole would give off X-rays and gamma rays at a rate of about 10 million megawatts, enough to power the world's electricity supply. It wouldn't be easy, however, to harness a mini black hole. You couldn't keep it in a power station because it would drop through the floor and end up at the center of the Earth. If we had such a black hole, about the only way to keep hold of it would be to have it in orbit around the Earth. People have searched for mini black holes of this mass, but have so far not found any. This is a pity, because if they had, I would have got a Nobel Prize. Another possibility, however, is that we might be able to create micro black holes in the extra dimensions of space-time. According to some theories, the universe we experience is just a four-dimensional surface in a 10- or 11-dimensional space. The movie Interstellar gives some idea of what this is like. We wouldn't see these extra dimensions because light wouldn't propagate through them, but only through the four dimensions of our universe. Gravity, however, would affect the extra dimensions and will be much stronger than in our universe. This would make it much easier to form a little black hole in the extra dimensions. It might be possible to observe this at the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, at CERN in Switzerland. This consists of a circular tunnel, 27 kilometers long. Two beams of particles travel round this tunnel in opposite directions and are made to collide. Some of the collisions might create micro black holes. These would radiate particles in a pattern that would be easy to recognize. So I might get a Nobel Prize after all. As particles escape from a black hole, the hole will lose mass and shrink. This will increase the rate of emission of particles. Eventually, the black hole will lose all its mass and disappear. What then happens to all the particles and unlucky astronauts that fell into the black hole? They can't just re-emerge when the black hole disappears. The particles that come out of a black hole seem to be completely random and to bear no relation to what fell in. It appears that the information about what fell in is lost, apart from the total amount of mass and the amount of rotation. But if information is lost, this raises a serious problem that strikes at the heart of our understanding of science. For more than 200 years, we have believed in scientific determinism. That is, that the laws of science determine the evolution of the universe. If information were really lost in black holes, we wouldn't be able to predict the future, because a black hole could emit any collection of particles. It could emit a working television set, or a leather-bound volume of the complete works of Shakespeare, though the chance of such exotic emissions is very low. It is much more likely to emit thermal radiation, like the glow from red-hot metal. It might seem that it wouldn't matter very much if we couldn't predict what comes out of black holes. There aren't any black holes near us. But it is a matter of principle. If determinism, the predictability of the universe, breaks down with black holes, it could break down in other situations. There could be vertical black holes that appear as fluctuations out of the vacuum, absorb one set of particles, emit another, and disappear into the vacuum again. Even worse, if determinism breaks down, we can't be sure of our past history either. The history books and our memories could just be illusions. It is the past that tells us who we are. Without it, we lose our identity. It was therefore very important to determine whether information really was lost in black holes, or whether, in principle, it could be recovered. Many scientists felt that information should not be lost, but for years no one suggested a mechanism by which it could be preserved. This apparent loss of information, known as the information paradox, has troubled scientists for the last 40 years, and still remains one of the biggest unsolved problems in theoretical physics. Recently, interest in possible resolutions of the information paradox has been revived as new discoveries have been made about the unification of gravity and quantum mechanics. Central to these recent breakthroughs is the understanding of the symmetries of space-time. Suppose there was no gravity and space-time was completely flat. This would be like a completely featureless desert. Such a place has two types of symmetry. The first is called translation symmetry. If you moved from one point in the desert to another, you would not notice any change. The second symmetry is rotation symmetry. If you stood somewhere in the desert and started to turn around, you would again not notice any difference in what you saw. These symmetries are also found in flat space-time, the space-time one finds in the absence of any matter. If one put something into this desert, these symmetries would be broken. Suppose there was a mountain, an oasis, and some cacti in the desert. it would look different in different places and in different directions. The same is true of space-time. If one puts objects into a space-time, the translational and rotational symmetries get broken. And introducing objects into a space-time is what produces gravity. A black hole is a region of space-time where gravity is strong. Space-time is violently distorted, and so one expects its symmetries to be broken. However, as one moves away from the black hole, the curvature of space-time gets less and less. Very far away from the black hole, space-time looks very much like flat space-time. Back in the 1960s, Hermann Bondi, A.W. Kenneth Metzner, M.G.J. van der Berg, and Rainer Sachs made the truly remarkable discovery that space-time far away from any matter has an infinite collection of symmetries known as supertranslations. Each of these symmetries is associated with a conserved quantity, known as the supertranslation charges. A conserved quantity is a quantity that does not change as a system evolves. These are generalizations of more familiar conserved quantities. For example, if space-time does not change in time, then energy is conserved. If space-time looks the same at different points in space, then momentum is conserved. What was remarkable about the discovery of supertranslations is that there are an infinite number of conserved quantities far from a black hole. It is these conservation laws that have given an extraordinary and unexpected insight into process in gravitational physics. In 2016, together with my collaborators Malcolm Perry and Andy Strominger, I was working on using these new results with their associated conserved quantities to find a possible resolution to the information paradox. We know that the three discernible properties of black holes are their mass, their charge, and their angular momentum. These are the classical charges that have been understood for a long time. However, black holes also carry a supertranslation charge. So perhaps black holes have a lot more to them than we first thought. They are not bald, or with only three hairs, but actually have a very large amount of supertranslation hair. This supertranslation hair might encode some of the information about what is inside the black hole. It is likely that these supertranslation charges do not contain all of the information, but the rest might be accounted for by some additional conserved quantities, superrotation charges, associated with some additional related symmetries called superrotations, which are, as yet, not well understood. If this is right, and all the information about a black hole can be understood in terms of its hairs, then perhaps there is no loss of information. These ideas have just received confirmation with our most recent calculations. Strominger, Perry and myself, together with a graduate student, Sasha Harko, have discovered that these superrotation charges can account for the entire entropy of any black hole. Quantum mechanics continues to hold, and information is stored on the horizon, the surface of the black hole. The black holes are still characterized only by their overall mass, electric charge, and spin outside the event horizon. But the event horizon itself contains the information needed to tell us about what has fallen into the black hole in a way that goes beyond these three characteristics the black hole has. People are still working on these issues, and therefore the information paradox remains unresolved. But I am optimistic that we are moving towards a solution. Watch this space.
Is falling into a black hole bad news for a space traveller?
Definitely bad news. If it were a stellar mass black hole, you would be made into spaghetti before reaching the horizon. On the other hand, if it were a supermassive black hole, you would cross the horizon with ease, but be crushed out of existence at the singularity.
6. Is time travel possible? In science fiction, space and time warps are commonplace. They are used for rapid journeys around the galaxy or for travel through time. But today's science fiction is often tomorrow's science fact. So what are the chances of time travel? The idea that space and time can be curved or warped is fairly recent. For more than 2,000 years, the axioms of Euclidean geometry were considered to be self-evident. As those of you who were forced to learn geometry at school may remember, one of the consequences of these axioms is that the angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. However, in the last century, people began to realize that other forms of geometry were possible, in which the angles of a triangle need not add up to 180 degrees. Consider, for example, the surface of the Earth. The nearest thing to a straight line on the surface of the Earth is what is called a great circle. These are the shortest paths between two points, so they are the routes that airlines use. Consider now the triangle on the surface of the Earth made up of the equator, the line of 0 degrees longitude through London, and the line of 90 degrees longitude east through Bangladesh. The two lines of longitude meet the equator at a right angle, or 90 degrees. The two lines of longitude also meet each other at the North Pole at a right angle, or 90 degrees. Thus one has a triangle with three right angles. The angles of this triangle add up to 270 degrees, which is obviously greater than the 180 degrees for a triangle on a flat surface. If one drew a triangle on a saddle-shaped surface, one would find that the angles added up to less than 180 degrees. The surface of the Earth is what is called a two-dimensional space. That is, you can move on the surface of the Earth in two directions at right angles to each other. You can move north-south or east-west. But of course, there is a third direction at right angles to these two, and that is up or down. In other words, the surface of the Earth exists in three-dimensional space. The three-dimensional space is flat. That is to say, it obeys Euclidean geometry. The angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. However, one could imagine a race of two-dimensional creatures who could move about on the surface of the Earth, but who couldn't experience the third direction of up or down. They wouldn't know about the flat three-dimensional space in which the surface of the Earth lives. For them, space would be curved and geometry would be non-Euclidean. But just as one can think of two-dimensional beings living on the surface of the Earth, so one could imagine that the three-dimensional space in which we live was the surface of a sphere in another dimension that we don't see. If the sphere were very large, space would be nearly flat, and Euclidean geometry would be a very good approximation over small distances. But we would notice that Euclidean geometry broke down over large distances. As an illustration of this, imagine a team of painters adding paint to the surface of a large ball. As the thickness of the paint layer increased, the surface area would go up. If the ball were in a flat three-dimensional space, one could go on adding paint indefinitely and the ball would get bigger and bigger. However, if the three-dimensional space were really the surface of a sphere in another dimension, its volume would be large but finite. As one added more layers of paint, the ball would eventually fill half the space. After that, the painters would find that they were trapped in a region of ever-decreasing size, and almost the whole of space would be occupied by the ball and its layers of paint. So they would know that they were living in a curved space and not a flat one. This example shows that one cannot deduce the geometry of the world from first principles as the ancient Greeks thought. Instead, one has to measure the space we live in and find out its geometry by experiment. However, although a way to describe curved spaces was developed by the German Bernhard Riemann in 1854, it remained just a piece of mathematics for 60 years. It could describe curved spaces that existed in the abstract, but there seemed no reason why the physical space we lived in should be curved. This reason came only in 1915, when Einstein put forward the general theory of relativity. General relativity was a major intellectual revolution that has transformed the way we think about the universe. It is a theory not only of curved space, but of curved or warped time as well. Einstein had realized in 1905 that space and time are intimately connected with each other, which is when his theory of special relativity was born, relating space and time to each other. One can describe the location of an event by four numbers. Three numbers describe the position of the event. They could be miles north and east of Oxford Circus and the height above sea level. On a larger scale, they could be galactic latitude and longitude and distance from the center of the galaxy. The fourth number is the time of the event. Thus one can think of space and time together as a four-dimensional entity called space-time. Each point of space-time is labelled by four numbers that specify its position in space and